Ladies and gentlemen, we meet today at the most difficult and crucial period in the history of the whole nation. But in a way, it's a period of hope. I was imbued with some hope as I listened to Miss Orpah as she spoke, because here's a child of the Black Revolution in our country. Here's a child of the new self-assertion on the part of black people in the United States. I also was filled with hope as I looked out upon you, because those militants and radicals at Berkeley are in a real sense the child of the Black Revolution too. Your free speech movement of some time ago was a direct derivative of the fight that black people and their allies were waging in the South some years ago. Now the movement of black people has moved into a new phase. In the past, we've been mobilizing. Now we are seeking to organize. And that organization has brought about confusion in the minds of many people as to what we are aiming at. We are called racists. We are called black racists, or segregationists in reverse. I don't know what kind of segregationist that is. But brothers and sisters, let me tell you that the movement of black people in the country now is just at the stage of translating the phony victories of the past into meaningful change in the life situation of the average black man in the United States. I get sick and tired of hearing of all of the progress that we have made in the past. That progress has been minuscule. It is true that black people who have a little money and who have a little education have greater upward mobility today than they had 13 years ago when the so-called civil rights revolution began. The black PhD has it made, in a way. He finds that he's still black, of course. But he will be offered jobs by universities all over the country. I'm now teaching at Lincoln University, a quote, predominantly Negro university, unquote, in Pennsylvania. And at the end of the school year, the top quarter of the graduating class was barraged with offers from industry. Every company was looking for its highly qualified, highly skilled, educated, highly personable young black man. You know, everyone must have one now. And a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine called me and said, you know what, Jim? Said, I just got a big job with a big corporation starting out at $12,000 a year. And he said, I don't have to do nothing except sit close to the door and look very Negro. He called me last week and said he got fired because he wasn't dark enough. They needed greater visibility than they had. Well, this is the token Negro, you know. But I don't knock it. I don't knock that at all, really. Because it's at least one foot in the door, and many people have fought and died for that dubious privilege of having the token Negro there. My point, however, is that the little fellow, the little black man in the streets of the ghettos, north and south in our country, is precisely where he was before the so-called civil rights revolution began. In fact, relatively speaking, he is worse off. Relatively speaking, his plight has deteriorated. The gap between his average income and the average income of the rest of America has widened and is still widening. Unemployment among whites in our country is declining, according to the Department of Labor, but unemployment among black people is increasing. The thrust of the civil rights movement a few years ago was aimed at knocking down the barriers of segregation. But look at it. Segregation has been increasing while people were dying and going to jail. There's more residential segregation now than there ever was. Now, black people are saying we've got to add something new to this struggle. No longer will the appeal to conscience be enough. And that's what the movement has been based upon in the past, saying, please, let me stimulate your conscience. Let let you see the great evils that have been done to us. And hopefully you will change. It has not worked. The appeal to conscience has found that racism has no conscience.